In this weekend's episode, two interviews from this past week's Washington Journal. First, Kirk Bedo, editor of National Journal's Hotline political newsletter, discusses campaign 2024 and key congressional races. Then we get an update on the Russia-Ukraine conflict and Russian President Vladimir Putin's future with William Pomerantz, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
We begin with a conversation with Kirk Bedo, editor of the National Journal political newsletter The Hotline, and a preview of the upcoming battle over control of Congress in 2024.
We are a very narrowly divided Congress. Democrats have the majority by one seat in the White House, and in the House, Republicans have a 5-seat majority, and it's a very deeply divided Congress right now, which means that the race for the House and the battle for the Senate next year are going to be extremely competitive and going to be one on the margins right now.
And, President Biden's approval rating is at 43%. That's according to Real Clear Politics. How are Democratic congresspeople reacting to President Biden? Are they distancing themselves? Are they embracing him?
They're still embracing him. They're dancing with the one that brought him. And they think President Biden, and especially with former President Trump leading the Republican side right now, is their best bet against Trump. And so they're not fully running away from him yet, and they're running on his popular program. So the infrastructure bill, you're going to see President Biden touting that a lot on trips to these congressional districts with those Democratic members right there with him. They're not running from him. You know, President Biden always has that line, you know, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. And Republicans are looking at the Democrats are looking at the alternative of former President Trump and the more extreme views on some of these Republicans and saying, this is what we got right now.
Well, I want to show you something, what President Biden said in Chicago last week, talking about
Bidenomics.
Thank you. And here's a portion of what he said, and then I'll get your response.
And guess what? Bidenomics is working. When I took office, the pandemic was raging and our economy was reeling. Supply chains are broken. Millions of people unemployed. Hundreds of thousands of small businesses on the verge of closing after so many had already closed. Literally hundreds of thousands on the verge of closing. Today, the U.S. has the highest economic growth rate leading the world economies since the pandemic, the highest in the world. As Dick said, with his help, we've created 13.4 million new jobs. More jobs in 2 years than any president has ever made in four, in two. And folks, it's no accident. That's Bidenomics in action. Bidenomics is about building an economy from the middle out and the bottom up, not the top down. And there are three fundamental changes that we decided to make with the help of the Congress. We've been able to do it. First, making smart investments in America. Second, educating and empowering American workers to grow the middle class. And third, promoting competition to lower costs to help small businesses.
That was the president in Chicago last week. So, Kirk, how's that playing in Congress?
Well, right now, the employment rate is down. The unemployment rate is down. You know, the economy is in pretty good shape right now. But the question is, are voters feeling that? And right now, in survey after survey that we've seen, voters rank the economy and battling inflation as their number one, number two issues. And they're just not feeling the same effect that President Biden is talking about right now. They're not feeling it when they go to the grocery store. They're not feeling it at the gas station still. And the president has very little control over those things. So that's why he's touting the investments and, you know, making things in America. You have the CHIPS Act as well. But it's about translating that to voters right now. And that's going to be his challenge as he really ramps up his reelection campaign and Democrats start hitting the trail as well.
Well, let's talk about the House specifically. Democrats are going to need five seats. How is that looking right now?
Well, it looks about like that Gallup poll that we showed a little bit earlier here, where it's just equally divided right now. We've had a few Supreme Court cases these last few weeks that have really kind of upended what we thought the mid-cycle redistricting process was going to look like. It looked like at the beginning of this year that Republicans were going to be able to draw themselves a few more extra seats, either through Ohio or in North Carolina. But after these Supreme Court rulings that broke in Democrats' favor, you know, we're going to have new lines in Alabama, probably have new lines in Louisiana as well. It looks like it's almost going to be a wash right now, where it's a toss-up right now. The big race for the House, the concentrated, where both parties are going to be looking, are going to be in the 23 crossover seats. Those are seats where representatives from a different party hold a district that the presidential candidate in the other party won. 18 Republicans, 5 Democrats. Now, the 18 Republicans are mostly in New York and California, and that's going to be the center of the race for the House.
And going back to that Supreme Court case, this does that mean this is the Alabama case? Does that mean that Alabama and Louisiana are most likely going to pick up a seat for the Democrats?
Yeah. So what basically that ruling found that the GOP drawn maps in Alabama violated certain parts of the Voting Rights Act. Now, Governor Kay Ivey down in Alabama has called a special session. They'll have to redraw the lines by, I believe, July 21st. And it has to be a black majority district because there's only a single black majority district in Alabama right now. So Democrats will most likely be favored in those seats. It just depends on, you know, in this game of redistricting musical chairs, which one of the Republicans, either Joe Carl or Barry Moore, end up in a seat that is not drawn to their favor right now. And same thing in Louisiana, where it's this musical chairs where Representative Julia Letlow, the freshman, might be in trouble there as well. But those seats should favor Democrats in a redraw.
And I know it's still too early to make a prediction about control of the House, but it looks like it's in play for the Democrats to retake it.
It absolutely is in play. When you have these narrow margins here and you have so many districts with Republicans representing an area that President Biden won, Democrats are in pretty strong position to retake the House right now. And frankly, you know, we could have a scenario for the first time since 2006 where both chambers flip.
All right. And let's take a look at a portion of House Republican Conference Chair Representative Elise Stefanik. She outlined GOP priorities and its stance toward the Biden administration. And I'll get your reaction.
The Biden administration continues to egregiously weaponize the federal government against Joe Biden's top political opponent. This abuse of power is rotting out numerous federal agencies. The unequal application of justice by Joe Biden's DOJ must be stopped. There cannot be one set of rules if your last name is Biden or Clinton, and another set of rules for everyone else. House Republicans will continue to deliver much-needed oversight to cut out the rot in these federal agencies and deliver accountability and transparency for the American people as we continue to work hard to implement our commitment to America. Last week, while it should not have taken a threat of contempt, the House Oversight Committee successfully demanded and reviewed critical documents from the FBI regarding Joe Biden's corruption. This week, we will hold the Biden administration accountable by standing up for the American people to stop the outrageous and really insane ban on gas stoves, a bad idea that started in New York that is now being embraced by every Democrat and the Biden administration. We will pass the RAINS Act and the Separation of Powers Restoration Act of 2023, and House Republicans will stand up for Second Amendment rights with H.J. Res 44, a resolution restoring constitutional rights, especially for our disabled veterans, our wounded warriors.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And Kirk, she talked about a lot of stuff there. How is that playing? Are those good general election issues?
Well, it almost feels like you heard Chairman GOP Conference Chair Stefano there even invoke the Clintons in there. And it kind of gives me the reminder of the Benghazi hearings in 2015 that were kind of designed on paper to hold the Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, accountable, but were really about bruising her up a little bit before the presidential primary. And that's kind of what we're feeling here with these oversight hearings right now. And, you know, she mentioned the gas stove issue. She mentioned, you know, the different applications of the law. Now, these are important things, and the oversight is important. And investigating what's going on at the DOJ, especially as it relates to the investigation of Hunter Biden, is important. But if you're a voter who is deciding whether or not to vote for Democrats or Republicans based on gas stoves, I think you are not necessarily a swing voter.
And let's talk about the Senate now. So what are you watching there? What seats could be in play there?
The Senate is, again, just as divided as the House, and it's a toss-up right now. Now, the map does favor Republicans slightly. There are 23 Democrats who are up for re-election, 11 Republicans. And the top seats that Republicans are targeting to flip the chamber are John Tester in Montana, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, and Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Of those 23 Democratic-held Senate seats, you know, those are the only three where Trump has really blown them out of the water there. You know, 39 points in Montana, I think 39 points in West Virginia, 18 in Montana, and 8 in Ohio. Those are going to be very, very vulnerable seats. However, you know, it's not just, you know, the map that is your destiny here. It's also the candidates. Now, Republicans had a really big issue last year in the Senate with poor candidate recruitment and some more, as Charlie Cook likes to say, exotic nominees on the Republican side who were able to sail through a primary but were a little unpalatable to general election voters. And that's the trouble that Republicans are trying to counter right now.
I wanted to ask you about recruitment because there are some holes and there's some states that are struggling with that.
Absolutely. And it's in those kind of second tier competitive seats. So we mentioned Montana, Ohio, and West Virginia. Republicans have gotten some big recruits in all three of those right now. They got Tim Sheehy in Montana. Governor Jim Justice is challenging Joe Manchin in West Virginia. Ohio has a few very competitive folks in there, too. But in those next level of competitive seats, I'm talking Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, even Nevada, they're struggling to field a solid general election candidate there. In Wisconsin, Mike Gallagher, who's more of a moderate Republican, who's been able to kind of carve his own lane and break from Trump a few times, said he is not going to challenge Tammy Baldwin and will instead chair the Select Committee on China in the House. In Michigan, Elisa Slotkin, the Democratic representative who has won competitive race after competitive race as a fundraising juggernaut, is the only major candidate in the Democratic primary right now without much of a Republican challenger. And she's going to be a tough out even under the best conditions. And right now, Republicans aren't putting themselves in the best conditions to compete there.
You wrote an article for the National Journal called Courting Disaster about the Supreme Court's decisions. Tell me about what you think that would be, how that's going to play in this in the congressional campaigns.
Well, we mentioned the redistricting cases, so that's Alan Mulligan, the one in Alabama, the Moore v. Harper one as well, that kind of rejected this fringe legal theory about the state, independent state legislature theory, and made sure and preserved kind of the judicial overview of how states conduct elections. So those were big decisions on their own. But then if you look at these other Supreme Court cases that have dealt with more cultural wedge issues, so the affirmative action case, you look at the Biden student loan forgiveness program right now. And in that article, I wrote a little bit about how progressives are going to really start calling for Biden, and they have already, to expand the court, to do something about this. And President Biden again and again has said, no, we're not going to expand the court. And if the most he can do is kind of shake a fist at the Supreme Court while he's getting these defeats to, you know, the popular student loan program or affirmative action is now completely rearranged, which was a big Democratic priority, then it just shows him to be, at least in some voters' eyes, as ineffectual. You know, you have all these questions that you talked about in your last segment about his age, about how dissatisfied voters are with him. Now, this could trickle down to congressional races as well, where those leaning younger voters who lean traditionally a little bit more Democratic might end up staying home because it's like, why bother? And now, you know, in a presidential race, that's, you know, pretty influential, but that also has effects down ballot as well, where these defeats at the Supreme Court level could damper voter enthusiasm and put congressional Democrats in a tough spot.
What about Roe v. Wade? How big of an issue will abortion be in congressional races?
Massive. It's, you know, I think we might have underestimated it a little last cycle, and much to the Democrats really seized on that issue. Now, after the court last year overturned the protections for abortion and Roe v. Wade, Republicans really didn't have an answer for it. They were able to, for so long, talk about, you know, our stance on abortion is, you know, we don't like it, but this is the precedent right now. This is what's been codified in Roe v. Wade. They don't have that anymore, and they've struggled for the last year to find a sort of palatable message that gets them through the primary with their base of more conservative voters who are a little bit more extreme on restricting abortion access. So that's like the 6-week abortion ban, a heartbeat abortion ban, with the more general election, who, you know, voters are still kind of uncomfortable with even like a 15-week abortion ban. And Republicans still have not found a good talking point to solve that issue right now. And Democrats are really going to seize on it.
That was Kirk Beto of the National Journal political newsletter, The Hotline. Next, William Pomerantz, director of the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute, gives an update on the Russia-Ukraine conflict and Russian President Vladimir Putin's future after the recent coup attempt.
A little bit about the Institute and the perspective it brings when it talks about these issues.
The perspective is a deep understanding of Russia, Ukraine, and really the post-Soviet space. And the objective of the Kennan Institute, a program within the Wilson Center, is to promote understanding of what is now a very difficult and complicated region, and it is always changing.
What do you think is the most misunderstood thing about this conflict going on?
I think the most misunderstood thing about the conflict is Russia's imperial ambitions, that Russia has reasserted its imperial goals to the extent that this is a mission by Vladimir Putin to attach territory to the Russian Federation, whether it's in Crimea, whether it's in Luhansk and other parts of the former of Ukraine. So I think what is misunderstood is that this is an imperial goal for the Russian Federation. And I think not only has the United States understood that, but the Europeans have understood that, and they know well about the dangers of empire.
Is this just about then gaining real estate, or are there other motives there?
Oh, no. I think it's not only gaining real estate, but also gaining control over Ukraine and the narrative of Ukrainian history, that somehow Ukraine is not a nation, that Ukraine is a part of the Russian empire and has been a part of Russia for centuries. So I think Putin has really gone after the notion of an independent Ukraine. Indeed, on several occasions, he's looked at maps of the 18th and 19th century, and he exclaims, well, there's no Ukraine, and therefore Ukraine really doesn't exist. So I think the focus of Putin and his goals in Ukraine and this war is to dismember Ukraine as a nation.
Because the war has been as long, going on as long as it has, is Putin strengthened or weakened by the continued effort, and that there hasn't been a resolve yet?
I think it is up in the air. I think Putin has decided that he is in this for the long term, as is Ukraine. And this has become a war of attrition, and there really no one has the upper hand, including the Ukrainians, who have obviously engaged now in a counteroffensive since June. So I think Putin is really focused on victory, as is Ukraine, and I don't think there's any sort of middle ground as of right now to resolve this crisis.
How would you assess the counteroffensive?
The counteroffensive is going slower, I think, than people expected. But I think that was because of expectations that the previous attack of Ukraine against Russia in Kharkiv and in other parts of the Russian Federation were so successful, and so successful very quickly. The Russians have been able to reinforce its troops in Ukraine. It has been able to lay out mines and so forth. That makes it very difficult for Ukraine to attack. And so I think the expectations of a quick victory for Ukraine has not been realized. But I think that was because of really the expectations that the Ukrainian army placed in the aftermath of the beginning of the war.
What do you think has been the strength of the Ukrainians in keeping up?
Well, the strength is simply that the Ukrainian army has overperformed. And I think people thought that when Putin invaded Ukraine, that he would be able to essentially wipe out Ukraine in a couple of weeks. That was Putin's expectation. That clearly has not happened. The Ukrainian army has been very valiant in terms of fighting the Russians. And there was no real quick victory for the Russians. And therefore, the fact that the conflict is ongoing has been a important stage of Ukraine and really founding of Ukrainian statehood. There's no better movement to create a national campaign than a war, an unjust war, engaged against Ukraine. And I think Ukraine has responded by really creating much more of a multicultural nation that is able to withstand this conflict.
Aside from the manpower, then, what about the supplies needed to conduct such a campaign? And talk about NATO and the United States' role in that.
So the United States and NATO have been supplying Ukraine. They have been increasingly giving weapons, tanks, artillery, etc. I think the Ukrainian army has been very well equipped now going into this counteroffensive. And so the United States and Europe have basically decided to support Ukraine from a military standpoint. Whether that ultimately leads to NATO membership for Ukraine is an open question. There have been signs that that NATO is open to a potential Ukrainian membership, but there are a host of bureaucratic issues that have to be resolved before that happens.
Do you think that should happen?
I think that in light of the atrocities that have been committed by Russia against Ukraine, in light of the vulnerability of Ukraine, and in light of the need to defend Ukrainian statehood, I think Ukraine is on the path not only to NATO membership, but also to a membership of the EU.
There was a story in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago about the possibility of long-range missiles being sent by the United States to Ukraine. If that comes out, what do you think of that as a strategy?
Anything that strengthens Ukraine at this point is a positive. I'm sure that the United States and the U.S. allies are concerned as to how the Ukrainians use these weapons. But I think in light of all the human rights abuses and aggression of Ukraine, I think that defending Ukraine is a maximum strategy.
If you're saying use as a means of offense, is that something you can agree with?
Yes.
Why so?
Well, because I think Ukraine is under attack. And I think that in terms of being able to defend itself and its sovereignty, I think Ukraine has to be given the military equipment and the capability to defend Ukraine's sovereignty and its nation.
That was Russian expert William Pomerantz, director of the Kennan Institute at the Wilson Center in Washington. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.